The Attack Zone, Season 4, Episode 6, Playtesting! Hello there, Dice fans! You have stepped once again into the Attack Zone, where we bring you the A to Z of competitive Dice Masters, wherever you get your fine podcasts, and now also on Twitch. If you're not sure what we're talking about last episode and some of the banter this episode, you're certainly welcome to come along, twitch.tv/facetheduke. That's my channel. I already have all the Twitch crap set up that I want to have set up to work with this. And so that's where we're doing it. So you can see our smiling faces as we do some of this stuff so that, I don't know, we can just have fun, be interactive. We're going to hang out with the chat and things like that. So, yeah. Joining me on the line, it's been a little while, but man, is he had a lot going on. So we won't fault him for this, is the Terror of the Great Salt Lake, Mike. Mike, welcome back at long last to the Attack Zone.
Thanks. It's been a long month or so since I've been able to get on with you guys. I've been missing it a lot.
Well, I'm glad we've been missing you. On the other hand, it's been really easy to get this started with just having two people at a time. Eventually, I hope to have all four. I got slot room right there and right over there we go, to get two more faces there. So, yeah. And CCM points out we can even be trolled live. So, yeah, come and do that, I guess. this is really cool. So, Michael, one of the things we were talking in the pre-show is about your absurd new game room.
Yeah, it's really nice. So I've got it's 1,000 square feet. I've got an area just for video games. I'm kind of a hardcore RPG-er, so... I've got about 8 systems hooked up to my TV over there with all the RPGs ranging from Nintendo all the way up to the latest PlayStation 4. Then I have a custom-built game table that's behind me. I said earlier I wish I could pull my camera around to show you. It's pretty cool. I had it built by a local carpenter here. And I have a ton of board games. So when I'm not playing Dice Masters, I'm picking up one of those games and playing them. I'm just lucky my wife is understanding enough to let me have it.
I'll tell you what, when I talk to people, and sometimes it feels like we have a lot of board games, and then I think about you, and I know you have a few times more than we do, and we have a fair amount. if I recall correctly, though, your collection count is substantially higher than ours. So a tip of the invisible cap to you. Yeah, we have some of the same kind of stuff, but it's all spread about. We have an entertainment center in the basement with an old TV that the previous owners left us, but it works, and it's perfect for the old consoles, right? I have tons of Sega stuff, and Sega's always been my jam. I've actually, you talk about RPGs, I've been working through Phantasy Star 4 on this channel lately. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the Sega Genesis RPGs.
Oh, yeah.
I certainly go a little less. Okay. Amazing game. I love it so much. Phantasy Star 2 was the first RPG I ever played. So certainly I have that fever there, too. So that's awesome. Cool. Well, Mike, we have a six-pack, so what better way to start off your foray back here with us than with a six-pack? I opened it pre-show, so... these are the cards that somebody said, are you crazy? Are you a masochist? You're going to just leave these on your desk? And I said, yeah, I can do it. And so I did. I didn't touch those cards. 6 boosters, unknown. Here they are. Let's start off with Yellow Jacket. This is the common. Of course, we're in the commons. And the common Yellow Jacket is not so special. It's blank. But it's a 3 cost. So, what do you think? High pick or no?
Well, I mean, if you've got nothing else in draft, grab it. But, yeah, I wouldn't be grabbing that. Probably unless it was last one or two.
Not at all. We're going to try and get the images to happen here, but this website's not agreeing with me totally. Hey, there we go. Blank card image. All right, so then let's move forward. At the other end of the spectrum, a 7 cost villain, Ronan the Accuser. Judgment Day. When fielded, Ronin gets +2 attack if there are no other dice in your field zone, and that's just until the end of turn.
That's crazy for a 7 cost. I mean, you can theoretically get 7 cost in draft, but for that ability, that's just terrible.
Yeah, it's not good. It's too much. It's not what we want out of a 7. Let's move forward to Agent Venom losing control. This website is agreeing with me much more. 4, Mask, Guardian of the Galaxy. He has call-out, so when he attacks, target character die is the only character die that can block him. If he targets a villain with call-out, he cannot be knocked out this turn. Fielding 011, 334455 is the ability. I like call-out a lot in this set. I don't know about you.
That card's killer. For a 4 cost, the call-out ability is just insane. I almost grab him instantly anytime I see him just because of how effective he is at clearing opponent's sidekicks, clearing pesky other characters, and because he forces himself to be blocked, you can pump him up with the Cloud Kill Global and just basically wipe out anything on your opponent's side that's been causing you pain. If for no other reason, his fielding cost is so low that you can KO some of the guys that have fielding costs of 2 or 3 and just brutalize your opponent for having to refield him every turn.
I completely agree. It's a neat card, and right now, I mean, just 3 cards deep, but right now that's certainly at the top of the pack for what we're dealing with here. Next up, then, is Yondu, 4 Bolt Guardian, Whistle While You Kill. I love that subtitle. When fielded, rather, Yondu deals 1 damage to all opposing character dice.
This actually is almost a win condition if you have the cube. If you have rare cube and you can do 3 damage to your opponent's entire team, you can set yourself up. Other than that, it's pretty weak, but if you somehow have grabbed rare cube, I would grab Yondu. I've won a couple drafts just with him.
I agree with that, but again, rare cube is a mighty high stipulation to get.
Sure.
Yeah. But that's a great combo for certain. All right, then, how about Sword Agent, Eyes Beyond Earth? And that is a 2-fist, no affiliation, ally. Sword Agent gets +1 defense for every other sidekick die in either player's field zone. And field 001, stats go 2-1, 2-2, and 3-2. It's not a bad defensive bonus.
Yeah, I wish he was more effective. I think this card's actually better not in draft. In competitive, I could see it more play, especially if you have enough sidekicks, you can flip him with a global or something like that. The defense bonus just doesn't come into play that often in draft. It's never saved me. So, I mean, he doesn't die, but he's as good a blocker as if you just got a sidekick. So, I don't know. It's a hard sell for me. He's not that great.
No, I'm with you there. All right, so Agent Venom still looking good to us. We have Quasar, Protector of the Universe, the 4 Bolt Guardian of the Galaxy. When Quasar attacks and is not blocked, you may pay Bolt if you do add Quasar to your prep area instead of moving her to the used pile.
It's a good ability. I mean, it's nice that you get to hit with her and goes to prep, but it's pretty limited. It just doesn't see much play. And with the cards in the set, it's hard to set up a combo with her.
Right. No, I agree with that. It's just, it's too situational. And plus, I mean, I don't know. It's not impressive to me. Next one, is Agent Venom again, so let's skip it. And that brings us into the uncommon. So we go there with Agent Venom being really the one that sticks out to us there. We have something pointed out in the chat. I don't remember if we said this or not, but he does point out that Sword Agent, the bonus can be flipped as it is static, not applied, and I believe that would be correct. I don't remember if we mentioned that or not, but it is a good thing, one way or another, to have pointed out, because there's a lot of confusion, I think, among some players about static versus applied, including sometimes us. So, yeah. But I think Agent Venom then sticks out there, but we have several uncommons. We got like 4 or 5 uncommons here. 4. So let's start with Nova Corps Uniform, the non-basic action. That's a 2-fist, stand for something greater. When fielded, equip to a character die. That character die takes no damage from villain character dice or globals. If that character die leaves the field zone, send this die to the used pile.
That's very, very specific.
Yeah. Too specific. Too limited for limited.
Play. Exactly.
Hmm. Does it bother you? I'm curious, and I haven't really brought this up with anybody else, but does it bother you a little bit that they used equip when that's kind of been like a specifically D&D only adventurers can be equipped with things term, if I recall?
I don't mind that. I kind of wish they made it a little bit more clear on the card, though. It acts like a continuous card because you equip yes. it on a character and stays in the field, but it doesn't say equip or anything like in italics or bolded. So you have to know that from the rule book. And I had some people arguing with me, okay, you equipped it for the turn, but now it's gone because it's not a continuous die. And technically equipment is continuous. So it's weird. I wish it was a little bit more clear.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's one thing that I, that just immediately popped out to me when I opened, because I think I opened like a CUR set. I just have 24 packs of this so far of Nova Corps uniform, and I looked at this and I said, wait, equip? Really? Uh-oh. All right, then. Ironheart. This is reverse-engineered the Avenger here, 5 bolts. And it reads, when fielded, you may add a die from your used pile to your bag. If you do it on burst, which is just the level 1 face here, you may add up to 2 dice instead. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, with again that burst face on level 1. I do have to say, I find the die to be kind of cool. This red with the purple swirled through. I'm a fan of this. I don't know if it's coming through there at all, but I think it looks neat. But what about the card?
You know, I like this card, not for draft. I like it for modern. I know it's a 5 mm-hmm. cost. I know it's a stretch, but you can do some crazy stuff with that. I mean, putting dice into your bag, that opens up a lot of avenues for some combos and things like that. So I like this card. I don't think it's great for draft, but I like its potential.
I agree. It's anytime you have that dice manipulation, you have to pay attention, but not necessarily in this case for draft. We need like straight up ramp more so than anything else if we're going to take a card like that in draft. So... Nowhere, the 4 mask non-basic action hive of scum and villainy. I thought that was Mos Eisley. You may spin all character dice in your reserve pool to level 3. You may field level 3 character dice for 1 generic energy this turn instead of their printed fielding cost.
So I can see this working. So if you get the uncommon cube, the one where you can buy a action die for 3 less, a combo I played is I had a Nova Corps uniform, the one that gave +2/+2 to a character it was equipped to, and then this mm-hmm. Nowhere, which allowed you to spin all your characters up to level 3. So if I could plan it right so that there was a turn where I was fielding a few people, I could set myself up with a cube to buy the Nova Corps uniform for 1 and then this for 1, and then I would have I would buy these dice really cheap, and then I could set up to field things really cheap. It's a lot of stuff you have to get it to work, though, and it's a little clunky. I can see potential. It's not great in draft.
Yeah, I agree with you. Hey, I want to point out for everybody listening that if you can't see the video now, you might understand sometimes a couple of thumps we can't edit out. Now I know what it is, Mike. You were a very demonstrative talker sometimes, and you're making gestures and hitting your desk, and I'm hearing that just a little bit.
Oh, I apologize.
Through the microphone. Hey, that's okay. That's okay. When it's on video, we know what's going on. We have another comment in the chat that says that they've tried to get Nowhere to work, but it really fits ... Nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it needs a lot to fire, and that's really the problem with it.
I can see it working, though, if you have something that can fabricate your team. So mm-hmm. Maybe you use Rip Hunter, fabricate, you put your clay golem into your prep area, you put the dice into prep area. Next turn, you know you're rolling Nowhere, you're fielding all these characters back at level 3, you've set your board up great. I mean, I can see stuff right. like that, but... it's hard to pull off.
It really is. All right, then. Our final uncommon is Sword Agent. Again, an ally, two fist, sentient world's observation. So an ally. When Sword Agent attacks, Sword Agent gets +1 attack if another character die is attacking. For a 2 cost, that's a fine ability. It does some stuff. The defense isn't terrible, and it can get an attack bonus if it's not alone. I don't think it's going to supplant Agent Venom here, which I think is still at the top of our pack.
No, that's a solid 2 cost. Anything that you can pump a character up, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Still Agent Venom on top, though, as we finish the uncommons?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Last one, we have Squirrel Girl, Super Squirrely. This is our rare, and I'm so sad that this is the one I have to give away, because I love Squirrel Girl so much, just as a character. She's my favorite. She's a four-fist Avenger, and her text is, when Squirrel Girl is blocked, she deals X damage to the defending player, where X is her attack, minus the number of blocking dice your opponent has declared this turn.
She's amazing. I mean, she's a win condition. She's a win condition, so she's great.
Yeah. Oh, and she's Squirrel Girl, so.
Exactly. I mean. I do think the uncommon Captain America is better than her. I mean, so he's easier to get, but she's still great. I'd definitely grab her first if I saw her.
Yeah, I think that. I think that pivots us firmly away from Agent Venom. That's a really cool card. I mean, just fielding 0-1-1, 3-3, 4-3, and 4-4, plus so many ways to just pump up attack or whatever else with whatever you choose to bring with you basic action-wise. I love it. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, do something like bring... Yeah, there's so many options with her.
Yeah. I love to be putting her picture up here, but it's not... Oh, there we go. We got our... beautiful and squirrely Squirrel Girl right there. So that's a 6-pack. We'll set the Squirrel Girl aside to go out with our Patreon backers, and we appreciate the support of those backers, of course, and as well as all of you watching and all of you listening. It's so cool that you guys are out there, and we love you for it. So, yeah. We're going to move into a topic that, boy, Mike, you are uniquely suited for. Again, I don't know if you had the time to listen last week, but JT made a comment somewhere towards the end of last show that it's scary playing against Mike because you know that whatever team you bring, he's played the matchup like 100 times. and he just knows it inside and out. And whatever situation you present him with, he's seen it and so forth and so on. And, I mean, boy, in articles and in our chats and whatever else, we see the... analysis that you bring to this, and it's absolutely wild, man. One thing that I think you probably do better than just about anybody else that I know, I'm not going to say just in Dice Masters, but I'm going to say maybe in CCGs, maybe except for some of like the high-end Magic Pro Tour people, is playtest. And I don't think that's pumping you up too much. I don't know, and that's why I'm here. I'm here to learn from you, because I do some playtesting, but it's not so thorough. I'll roll through some moves to myself. I'll work out scripting my early plays and what I want to do in different situations. And I'll go through some full games, and then I'll get on camera and I'll play with some other people. But it's not... like, when you talk about 100, it's literally 100. And I know you've brought up that number before. It's literally 100, isn't it?
Well, I feel like that's almost a minimum. I know that sounds crazy. Yeah. So you probably don't want to learn from me.
No, I want to.
And
your results speak for themselves, my friend.
It's easier to get through 100 games than you might think. But the idea is you need to know enough about your team that you know the secrets. You know the things that people aren't expecting. That you know, okay, if they do this situation, I can mess them up here. And you really don't know your team well enough to pick up those little things until you've played it about 100 times. And I'm not even joking. I'll play something 80 times, time 81, I'll notice a little combo. Oh, if they do this, I can do this. For example, one that I'm sure I brought it up before, but one of my favorites of all time is the, I'll use Kal-El to flip my characters sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the Cyborg Global, where you can turn one of your sidekicks into a shield, and a shield energy is what you need for Kal-El. So I'll attack with sidekick characters, multiple sidekick characters, more than they can block with. And then once they declare blockers, I will pick one of the character sidekicks that they blocked and flip him to the shield to use my Kal-El Global on whatever one they didn't block. And that's something that you don't... I didn't pick it up the first time I did. Normally, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to flip this guy to a shield. I'm going to attack. Now I have my shield for Kal-El. No, now I have forced him into a situation where one of my guys is going to get through, and it doesn't matter who they block. I'm turning one of them that they blocked into a shield to so I can kill them.
We've had some equal fun with things like transfer power and things like that. I know that's a fun thing that I like to do in drafts as well. So let's go then. You say it's easier than you think. Now, we're not just talking you play that team 100 times, though. You work through a lot of specific matchups a whole bunch of times as well, right?
Exactly. So how I normally go about it is I come up with an idea. I think, hey, this might have potential. I build a team around that idea. And then I research the meta. What is every potential team that this team can match up against? Then I line those teams up. It's kind of like I have a big table back here, and I line up four or five teams against the team I'm testing. I play it against the first team a quick 10 games, see how it did. If I do well against that team, I'll graduate it to the second team, or I might make a change. If it fails in the second team, then I've got to start over at the first team again after I've made some switches so I can beat that second team. I've got to beat all the teams in my row with my team with an idea before I consider it, you know, decent enough that I might bring to a WKO. So that takes some time. After I go about 10 games each with each one, if I do well, I make sure that I'm really solid with my team, and then I play it another 10 games against each of those teams to try and come up with any tricks. It's more than just winning. It's more like, how can I mess with the head of the person across from me at that point? So
right.
First I want to see if it's viable, then I want to know the tricks. I want to know how I can mess up the vicious struggle team. How can I mess up the sidekick rush team? How can I mess up this team? I want to see what I can do to really make this team destructive.
Now, how do you account for changes in the meta? We can say as simple as a new set's coming out, or we can say as complicated as this year where we had rotation, and the first time that it was going to impact things was, of course, right there on the Nationals and World Stage, the U.S. Nationals, rather, and the World Stage. So when you're researching the meta, what's your methodology for picking some of those things out and trying to figure out, what's going to be in the meta when we don't know the meta?
Sure. Well, at the end of the day, you can class the meta into groups. There'll always be an aggro team. There'll always be a burn team, something that's not direct damage. There'll be a control team. There'll be a combo team. So essentially, after you've found out what is winning, what is the control team that's dominating, I'll play against that matchup. And sometimes even when I'm playing against a meta team, I'll see what my team's weak against. And in the control team, I'll add pieces that will actually be hurtful to my team to see if I can still win with it, that kind of thing. So at the end of the day, even if you can't account for everything, because there's too many cards at this point, you cannot play test against everything. If you play test against a group, a control group, you know what you need to do to get around control pieces. You know what you need to do to disrupt control pieces with your team. Same with aggro. How am I faster? How can I defend against an aggro team? That kind of stuff.
So what you're trying to do then is to kind of figure out what's going to be the best of a specific archetype, as you said, or at least a specific speed of deck, aggro, control, mid-range, burn, what have you. And then test against that. So maybe it's not exactly what that deck looks like, but it's a reasonable facsimile, I suppose.
Exactly.
And then, okay, huh.
So if you if you're playing against a burn team, you find out what is the most meta burn team at the moment. What team is going to kill me turn four with just direct damage or, you know, ability damage, and then try and counter that. And even if someone brings a slightly different team, a drastically different team, you know how to fight that specific play style. so you'll know what to buy even if the cards are different.
Right, because it should be clear what they're trying to do just by seeing the abilities that they have, for the most part.
Exactly.
I mean, I guess on the one hand, that's where some things were a bit of a favor going into Worlds. I mean, we knew that, for example, Ring was going to be around. I mean, I don't think there was any doubt in anybody's mind that there was going to be a share of Ring teams.
Sure.
But let's say right now we're looking at some things coming up this fall, and right now we have just, you know, put Guardians of the Galaxy in. That's coming into the meta. We're going to shake it around and see what happens. How do you do it? Like, that's pretty cool when there's a wholesale change. How do you, like, judge where the archetypes have gotten stronger or weaker when we're putting in a new set? Or, on the other side of that, where there's maybe a fluff piece, something that seems like, oh man, this could really push this one archetype over the edge. But let's say it's just... Let's use this as an example. I think the Cosmic Cube Rare is awesome. I think it's good. I think it's going to have a place. I think it's going to do some things. But let's say that it turns out that because it's a non-basic action and it fits onto other teams that are action-oriented rather than character-oriented, it actually has a hard time winning. So how do you kind of differentiate, you know, especially early on in prep, between those pieces where we're adding in that enhance a deck versus... like the ones that appear to enhance a deck, like the sneaky, not as good cards. And I'm not saying the cube is one of those. That's just kind of an example to underscore the point.
Sure. So how many times do we sit on the reserve pool and we shoot out ideas to each other? We say, hey, with this combo, you might be able to win on turn five. That's just theory crafting. That's coming up with an idea. We haven't identified if that's viable, and we haven't identified if that's reliable yet. So honestly, what you're just saying there, hey, there's the rare cube. We think it's going to be good. We don't know it's going to be good. I would say that's when you play the 100 games. That's when you say, you know what? If I play my Vicious Struggle team with cube, I win so much more consistently than without it. If I don't play with cube, then this happens. I mean, that's what you need to identify. Can I win against these other meta teams better or worse by adding this card? If it makes no difference, then it's a fluff piece. I added cube to this. It didn't increase my win rate. I'm still 60% win rate with this deck. Take cube out. You don't need it. That's what you're trying to identify. You're trying to identify your win rate. I played 100 games with cube. Cube jumped me 10% on my win rate. I'm playing with cube. I mean, that's how you identify it. Until you actually get down and do the testing, it's all just guesswork and bragging to each other about you've come up with the ultimate idea.
Well, and I'll tell you too, that the theory crafting is something that you're very good at as well. A lot of you say we, and we all do kind of throw ideas in from time to time, but a lot of it is you saying like, hey, you know, if you do this and you do this and then you do that and then you do that, you wouldn't turn five. I'm like, oh yeah, I see that. And I didn't even think about that before. So we've seen some of the analytics that you've done with some of the sets before as well, and really running around with probability and so forth and so on to try and determine how likely is something to succeed, probably before you even sleeve it up to try and and put the team together to try and figure out if it's going to be viable or not. Can you speak a little bit to that side of the process?
Sure. So a little bit comes down to knowing your local meta, I think, as well. Yeah. So it's a little harder going to these big tournaments like Nationals and Worlds. This last year, I felt the most insecure about my team than anything, to the point where I didn't even bring a meta team. I brought my own little craft. It was fun, but it didn't do super great. And that was a little bit of a difference, because when you're playing in your local scene or you're playing at a WKO or something that's nearby, you should kind of know what the meta is. You should know what you're preparing against for the most part. So I think that comes up with your theory crafting, because you should know basically what you're up against. Hey, this guy always brings, Wolverine the best there is. I should prepare against that. My team can always beat Wolverine the best there is. Hey, this guy always brings Vicious Struggle. I should be prepared against that. So I think identifying your meta when you're doing your theory questing, identifying, you know, the crowd, and identifying on the world scene what's winning at the moment. People are nice enough to post online what's winning. If you can identify that, right, you realize, hey, this one guy always copies the latest net deck. I should prepare against that too. Right. So that comes into it. Another thing that comes into theory crafting is realizing that any team that can win turn five that can't win it if you're disrupted at all is probably not a great team.
Glass cannon. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's good to identify that when you're theory crafting. Okay, can I play this team in a control style and still win? Let's go back to Bard. When I play,
that was exactly what I was going to bring up. Go for it.
Yeah, when you play Bard, that was the reason that team was so good. You could do nothing but bring control pieces and win with Bard, and it was disgusting. No other point in the history of Dice Masters would you be able to play with such weak characters and still win. Yeah, you could disrupt your opponent, so he was so annoyed with trying to PXG he couldn't do it, but that's not a win condition. Suddenly, with Bard, not only are you annoying your opponent, you are winning by annoying your opponent. So, I mean, it's that kind of stuff. You got to identify, when are you defensive, when are you offensive? Does this theory actually hold up to that?
And the people who had trouble were the people who, like me, for a while, tried to build Bard in more of a glass cannon style. You see just the raw power of what it can do and the crazy damage that it can put forward that you try and build that way. And I really had to just come off it and say, okay, this isn't going to work. And I didn't see for a while why it couldn't work. But and, you know, obviously hindsight is 20/20, and I had to make a change. Here's a fun combo that just got brought up. Somebody would like to find a way to make small step for man, which is the basic action where you spin all character dice to level one, work with white dragon, which is the one where I believe those affected by or level one character dice damaged by the breath weapon can't block until the end of turn. That is a fun one. I'd like to find a way for that to work too. That's kind of cool. I'd like to get back though to your testing gauntlet, and your one, let's just make it clear, you're pretty much rolling through both sides of that on your own, correct?
Well, actually I'm not. How I do it is I identify how the other team's going to win. So how is the burn team that I'm currently playing against going to beat me? Then I roll my side as normal, and my opponent always rolls perfect. So I don't actually roll the dice for my opponent. I just grab four dice out of the bag, identify which would be the perfect four dice to draw out of the bag for him. Just, I don't even put them in the bag, I'm going to be honest. I stick them on top of the bag, and then I just say, okay, he drew these four because that would be his ideal four dice to draw that turn. And then I put them on the faces that would be most ideal for him. So he always rolls perfect. He always has exactly the energy he needs. He always rolls question marks, and his characters are on their perfect sides. If I can beat the team that this team and he is rolling perfect every time, then my team has a chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not a bad way to do it. So you're not really like, how deep into those games do you tend to go?
I go all the way. Whoever wins,
all the way to the end. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But my opponent's always perfect, and I'm rolling my team as normal.
That is kind of crazy. I hadn't thought of that. Wow. But it does make a lot of sense, I suppose, because I don't know. I think that your playtesting can really be changed a lot by how those rolls go. And if you just kind of say, oh, crappy roll, I win, and take that as a positive mark for your team, then that's not so great. And I suppose that might not come right there. I haven't heard of a lot of people playing like traditional CCGs that way, where you're drawing from the deck, because there are so many situational things that you can draw and use in a creative way, right? Whereas here, we're limited to a certain amount of pieces, we're limited in the amount of abilities that we can have work together, and so forth and so on, where that variance probably matters a whole lot more.
It's true. Something else I do too, I don't know if other people do this, is let's say I identify something a turn later, you know, like, oh, I forgot to do this. If I did it on my side, I forgot to do it, I need to remember. If my opponent, you know, the guy that's rolling perfect over there did it, he gets a takes backseat and I get the extra damage or whatever it does to screw me over. I mean, I think that's so important. It's kind of funny. I test a lot against Mask Ring because Mask Ring was such in the meta. And and it's really hard to beat Mask Ring when it rolls perfect. But once you can beat Mask Ring when it rolls perfect and it always rolls masks every time, when you play against a real Mask Ring team, you're like, man, this team's not that good compared to the perfect Mask Ring team.
That's kind of true. So basically, you're coming and having practiced against like the 100% ideal. And that probably makes up for the fact that when you're trying to put in those facsimile teams that we talked about earlier, like here's what I think is going to be the best aggro, the best control, whatever else, that probably means that since you're doing it that way with perfect rolls, whatever maybe slight misread or slight inefficiency made it into those decks as you were putting your best shot at putting them together, is made up for by the fact that, again, everything is just kind of perfect.
Exactly.
Huh. Well, I'm going to be re-listening. I'm going to, like, listen to this as I edit. Normally when I edit, I put on, like, 1.5 or 2 times speed so that I can just kind of get through it and find everything where I need to edit and it's done. I'm going to be, like, sitting there editing with it. This is going to be the longest edit job I've ever done as I take a few notes, because this has changed my perspective on how I have playtested. So I always start with my team. And I think that's still a good place to start, but I want to make sure
that's what I do too. Yeah, exactly.
And you just sit there and roll through a few turns, like probably like your first several turns, and just to kind of like get an idea of what can come up and what possibilities that enables.
Yeah,
that's where I've generally started.
Well, so when I'm playing against the first team that I'm playing against, mm-hmm. some of those turn games, first 10 games, I play the 10 games. If I lose like the first 5 or the first 3, I'm looking at my buy order. Am I buying things wrong? What do I need to switch up? Well, I thought this team was good. Why am I getting my butt kicked so hard? I don't really like roll against nothing. I don't go like, oh, look, mm-hmm. I did it perfect, so I went on turn 3. You got an opponent. I don't feel like rolling against nothing super effective, so I like rolling against an opponent and seeing how that messes up my buy order, because my opponent's trying to win too. He's not just sitting there with no defense. My opponent's smart enough to know what I'm trying to do, hopefully. If he doesn't, then yeah, I'll win turn 3 or 4 or 5. But I don't hope my opponent doesn't know what he's doing. That's not very good at winning.
No, and you can't make assumptions, and we've talked about that before. You know, the people who are coming to these events, for the most part, especially, I guess it depends on where you go to. If you're in an area that's just had solid store population, and so they get a WKO regional tournament, and maybe it is just a little bit of a lower play level because they're approaching the game differently, but it's their activity and a strong play group that earned than that WKO spot. I mean, okay, perhaps. But for the most part, you go to these events and you're going to be playing against a lot of other people who know the game, like the game, understand the game, and it's dangerous to assume that the person across from you is going to make that misplay, is not going to understand how to, how to manipulate things into their favor, or how to throw you off or whatever else. It would be a very big mistake to do that. Well, that is a lot to think about. What else is there? Anything else you can add here about the process or the selection of the teams you're going to play against, or really anything? Like, how can you fill in any of the gaps that we might have glossed over through this conversation?
Sure. A lot of times, people come up with some theories or something that are a great idea, but they're a great idea only if your opponent doesn't know what you're doing. Sometimes you can come up with a deck that's a little tricky, a deck that your opponent has no idea what it's going to do until you do it.
Phoenix Fastball?
Sure. Fastball, the first time Vicious Struggle, turn 3 kill, yep. Showed up. if that is a team you're going to go with, that team will probably do amazing until you get to top eight. So you need to identify that as well. Can your team that has its tricky little mechanic that no one's expecting do well once people know about the mechanic? So it's risky. It's super risky to play with that. I've almost never seen a team that comes with a mechanic like that win a WKO or anything, because as soon as someone figures out how to counter it and the counter is something people normally bring, you're going to be in trouble. So just keep that in mind too. If you play tested and you're like, hey, as long as this guy doesn't know what I'm doing, my team is will win every single time, I wouldn't count on that.
Right. Right. That makes sense to me. So let's wrap this discussion up then and move on to a quick Q&A, a couple of things that have come up in chat. Actually, just one really good one. I have my own opinions on this one, but I'll let you answer first. The question, we talked about Bard earlier. So about Bard and using weak characters, does that make Team Up the new Bard? And Team Up, for those who don't have it to reference right there, it's the basic action card. Each of your character dice get +1/+1 for each different affiliation among your active character dice, -1. So, until the end of turn, of course.
So Team Up is great. It's not Bard. It's almost as good as Bard. See, here's the advantage Bard has. Bard can sit in the field. So you filled him and you don't have all your pieces yet. He's just there. Team Up, you have to have your setup ready for when you roll Team Up. If you roll Team Up and your board's not ready, you've wasted that turn. You gotta wait 3 more turns for Team Up to come back around again for you to try and kill. So Team Up is great if you can manipulate when it comes. If you can consistently get it on the turn you need it to show up, Team Up is almost as good as Bard. It'll never be as good, but it gets a lot closer. In addition, Bard counted as one of the different characters, so he gave pluses to everyone else. So, and he got pluses. So he did Team Up's ability while doing more damage, and Team Up is that die, so you bought it, but you've got 3 or 4 or 5 less attack because you've got Team Up instead of Bard. That being said, it's great. If you can get it to show up consistently, if you can get it to show up on the team turn you need it, amazing. It's a little hard to make it that reliable. I definitely play with different ways to make it reliable. Understanding that there's more action hate with the new Scarlet Witch that's going to mess you up.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other things that are going to screw with your characters too. And something else to consider, you need another dice too on that turn, because you're going to need a Cloud Kill. You're going to need, and Prison's gone, but you're going to need something else so that your characters that are now buff can get through to hit. So now you're saying, I need to roll Team Up and I need to roll this other action die, or I need to have this other thing out that will clear their field so I can hit for all this damage. You're starting to set yourself up with a complicated win. I need a lot of pieces working on the exact same turn. So can teamwork work? Yes. Team Up work? Yes. Can I get it to work effectively and consistently? I have not been able to get it so far to work to a point where I'm comfortable bringing it. I love the idea. It's one of those theory crafts. Team Up is there. All my guys are Bard. It's Bard era again. And then you play with it and you're like, why can't I win every turn? Every game I play, why is this not effective as Bard? I played Bard. It doesn't seem to do it quite right.
Right. Well, and you know, that's where I fall as well. Not to mention the fact that we do have some more, we do have and are getting some things that'll make you lose affiliations, which can impact how this card works. And of course, it's open to everyone else. Now, there's the good point here: a giant spider for getting characters unblocked gives an extra affiliation, has a good global.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 2 cost, and that certainly could be a thing.
Personally, the best team I've seen Team Up work well on is a Gorilla Grodd team. Everyone has Overcrush. Mm-hmm. You attack with them, they all have +1.
Oh boy.
And now they're getting, you know, another +3 or 4. And the Overcrush will do it for you. So if you can, that's the team I've seen it work the best on.
Yeah, Gorilla Grodd is just such a beast. I mean, what a fun card to begin with. Then, you know, so much fun in draft. We've seen so much fun with him now in Constructed. I'm really glad that card's around, because it's a 7 cost.
Yep, it's a good card. You might want to check on the new Spider-Man as well, the one where is it Spider-Man? I think it is. The one where all the sidekicks have to be blocked first. Yeah, that's a Spider-Man. So all your sidekicks have to be blocked first before they can block character dice. And they can only assign one blocker per die, so that could work with team up. Some way to give them Overcrush as well would definitely be good.
Right. Here's another good question that came up. And actually, we're going to have to check on this, and I'm forgetting the web address for the WizKid solicits page right now. With First Class completely messing up the meta just before WKOs, any thoughts on the meta teams that are likely to show up? I can't remember specifically when that set drops, but some things that we already know about in there are, I mean, they're going to be there, right? October 18th looks like the release date for that right now, according to chat.
Well, it's a little hard. It's hard to predict what's going to be great with a set until it's out. Reason why is because until you have the cards in your hand, you're theory crafting, right? And we kind of talked about that a little bit. I love theory crafting, but I don't believe in it very much until I've seen some proven work, seeing how it fares. So the only way I've seen how to do it is I take other common Dice Master cards and I write on it the new cards coming out First Class, and then I put on teams early. I've done that a few times. I kind of like wait until the set comes out so I have the official cards, but it's hard. I have a ton of theories. I have some good ideas. It might be another Batman set that came out right before Nationals and Worlds. Didn't play a big part in almost in many of the teams that won. It did play some part. I mean, don't get me wrong, Darkseid was amazing.
Darkseid, yeah.
It was amazing, but there wasn't a ton of cards that really changed the meta. That seems to be the case with most sets. You'll see like a handful of 5 or 6 cards that really turn the game on its head, and the rest of the set are pretty much the same. So it's really hard to say how much First Class it's going to turn. There's going to be 5 or 6 cards that are amazing. Are they going to break the meta? We'll see.
Right. And we have a few examples there in chat right now. And rest assured, we're definitely going to get to a First Class episode. There's no way we can't. One, it's going to come out. Two, we'll have it in the 6-pack. Three, with it, you know, impacting competitive events exactly the way that we're talking about here. Of course, it's going to be addressed. Then you know, not too far behind that, not affecting the first round of WKOs, I don't believe, but we'll have Thor eventually, and we'll get things in there like Heimdall and our newly minted HXG, which I believe is what our friends across the pond have started to call it, and I'm totally fine with that name. That's going to be interesting, especially, you know, once per turn limits, if both players have it, we are almost going to be living in old PXG land to some extent, as long as both players have dedicated the slot to it. And I think there's a lot of people who won't dedicate slots to it. We've done a great job learning how to win without that card over the past while now, even before we had rotation occur.
Come on, I just want my Oracle to be useful again. So I'm all for Heimdall.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Oracle is going to be our best friend once more. Thanks to that card. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap this one up. Mike, anything you want to say on our topic or anything else that we've discussed here before we head out?
I think the only thing I would add is after you do your 100 games, play against some real people, because sometimes when you play against yourself, you get into patterns, and someone will show you something that you didn't think of and screw you up. So after you find out that, then whatever the person screwed with your deck on, go and practice that. That's my parting advice.
I can't agree more. Okay, thank you so much for listening. We know that there are lots of ways you could spend your time, and we appreciate that you choose to give some of it to us. The Attack Zone is a production of the Reserve Pool Network. Theme music is courtesy of Down Team Up. Promotional consideration has been given in the form of review product. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts, The Reserve Pool every Thursday and The Prep Area, running opposite Tuesdays from us. We're also going to continue to stream this as we are able, unless something crazy happens. So we should see you right back here in 2 weeks, streaming on the weekend with The Attack Zone. And until then, keep rolling.